don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on March 24th, 2018 and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and I react to the Boston March for Our Lives and the protest at Smith & Wesson in Springfield. Then we discuss historical radical activism in New England. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
So we are recording this on Saturday, March 24th, and we wanted to record it shortly after we attended the Boston March slash rally, whatever you want to call it, for the as part of the March for Our Lives movement stuff that it followed the aftermath of the Parkland shooting in Florida. And so we wanted to talk about a number of things surrounding that, as well as just our kind of initial reactions to that event. I think some people probably have heard their fill on this particular topic for right now, and I understand that. So if you're listening to the podcast version, the next segment on the show is about New England radicalism, and that'll be about 20 minutes in. This is, I felt like, kind of an interesting protest compared to some of the other. There's been a lot of these huge rallies in Boston over the past couple of years, and then going back a couple of years before that as well, there were also some Black Lives Matter demonstrations that happened as well. And I thought that this rally struck me. I mean, it was very well attended and everything, but it struck me as interesting in that it seemed like a majority of the people on stage were young people of color rather than white people. And, you know, as we've sometimes alluded to on this show, Boston has a challenging relationship with race and a lot of, you know, kind of not like either things will be all non-white people or all white people and not necessarily a good mix, not necessarily a representative mix. But, you know, that's especially important for younger for the younger generation, which is a lot less white, that this be sort of a multiracial, multi-tendency event. And so I felt like that was fairly well represented. I thought a lot of the speeches were about not just school shootings, but also issues of suicides, also issues of Black Americans that have been killed by police shootings or domestic violence, gun violence incidents, things like that.
You mentioned the Stephon Clark shooting where police shot a Black man carrying a cell phone in his grandmother's backyard 20 times.
They talked about, Nate, you were mentioning just before we started recording about Roxbury.
Back Bay is quite close to the common where this was being held. And they were saying that in Roxbury, about 80% of people are in some way affected by gun violence, whereas Back Bay, it's 10%. And obviously the demographics of those two areas are quite different.
Both the income and race demographics are significantly different. And I think that I could be wrong on this, but I think a lot of the sort of pre-existing gun control activists in Boston are people of color, especially among younger folks. There's obviously also plenty of Metro Boston area activists who are white suburban parents and stuff who've been involved with things like Everytown and groups like that and on gun control. But like within the city of Boston itself, a lot of folks who are active on this issue have actually been more concerned about like handgun violence and things like that, which Nate and I were talking a little bit before we were recording about sort of the interesting tides in the gun control discussion over the decades where, like, you know, there was a big focus on handguns in, you know, at one period. And then there was now it's a lot more focus on the AR type weapons, things like that, the longer guns. this seemed like a lot more of a leaning toward majority non-white, I think, than a lot of these other demonstrations that we've seen, but also very well attended compared to some. We've also been to some protests that were, you know, led by Black Bostonians or Indigenous people or whatever, and those often were very sparsely attended. And that was, you know, this was heartening to see. They had some of the speakers were actually survivors of being child soldiers, forced child soldiers in Democratic Republic of Congo, and they brought their own perspective to sort of globalize the gun violence problem and talk about the U.S. exporting gun violence to other countries. One of them mentioned, and we're going to circle back to this in a little bit in this segment, but the issue of the gun manufacturing companies. He said they keep making proceeds from these, you know, gun exports, and our people keep dying, but they don't care. A lot of the guns do come from the United States, and even if they're not made in the United States, they're often exported by U.S. companies or U.S. intelligence agencies in the military. And there was also someone there talking about, you know, issues like the violence in Iraq and Afghanistan and the U.S. role in that. We're coming up on the just past the 15th anniversary of the Iraq war starting. And that's the 15th anniversary of the 2003 one and does not take into account all of the U.S. military presence with the no-fly zones and everything through the 1990s, starting with the Gulf War. So that's, you know, coming up on three decades of U.S. involvement militarily in Iraq. I felt like there were a lot of topics that they covered. I know, Nate, you were a little frustrated by some of the content, like, you know, which it's always tough, I think, to find a balance on some of this stuff because it is kind of a complicated issue, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was certain aspects where it sort of felt like a dance party, where, I don't know, they were trying to keep people engaged. So I don't know.
Yeah, that was sort of an odd energy.
There was like a weird juxtaposition of like talking about like people committing suicide and being like massacred in classrooms, things like that. And then Drake, God's Plan playing.
Or like the cha-cha slide. And so, yeah, like, and yeah, that was sort of like, I kind of felt like I understood what they were going for. It was, I would characterize it as the world's angriest dance party. And also that they were trying to, like, this was, the people on stage were very young people, like under 25, with maybe two exceptions of adults that were helping them with stuff.
And,
but
yeah, and maybe that is sort of the spirit of this sort of young people's movement, where, you know, they're engaged on social media and they're
And trying not to be overcome with the sadness and anger,
right?
Or anything,
but they're,
so,
you know, they're still clearly quite angry. One of the speakers was, I think, their sister was at Parkland. Or...
Actually, it was. They had both the sister who goes to college here in Boston and the sister who was in the high school when the shooting happened.
And you could feel that anger there. Just we're being slaughtered. You know, people are doing nothing about it, and we really need to try to vote these people out. But, you know, that, and I've been watching, you know, New York, Chicago, all over the place.
So. I thought that they did a good job of focusing the specific proposals to Massachusetts-based proposals for this discussion, at least from what I heard while I was there. Because I think, like, the Washington one is probably talking more about, like, national sort of solutions, but they're saying, hey, you have Democratic supermajorities in Massachusetts, you could probably pass some more things here. The specific things being proposed here also seemed relatively reasonable, but also modest and moderate, which I think is another thing you've been raising is, like, are we actually going to, not to be, like, super cynical about it, but are we actually going to see any significant changes come out of this? In Massachusetts, maybe we'll see some changes, but who knows how big they will be. One of the proposals, for example, is like a voluntary list that people can sign themselves up for if they know they have like a mental health issue, like depression and things like that, or that they're at risk for suicidal thoughts, things like that. They can basically, when they're, you know, as they put it, on a good day, they can sign themselves up for that list. And then if you try to go buy a gun, the person that's selling it is supposed to consult that state list and say, okay, this person has basically taken themselves out of consideration and they must be heading down a particularly problematic path. And that, again, deals more with suicides than domestic violence issues, which is another big problem, or these mass shootings or anything like that. There is another proposal as well, and this starts to get into more controversial territory, where in a mental health crisis, they can temporarily take your gun away from you. But that leads to the question of, like, is the government just going to say, like, oh, this particular person that we don't like, you know, maybe they're an anti-police activist or something like that, or they have a gun to protect themselves for some other reason, they'll say, oh, this person's mentally ill, or they're having a mental health crisis, so we're going to take their gun away. You know, they're not going to do it to everyone all at once, so no one's really going to protest, but they do it individually to certain people. Like, and I don't know if that's really a reasonable fear or not, but I can definitely see why people are concerned about that. I think that's a completely valid thing to be concerned about. Moreover, you know, if they say, if someone like says, this person's in a, you know, like it's your mom or whatever, says this is in a mental health crisis, you got to come take his guns away. Are the police going to roll up with guns drawn and like shoot you down, you know, yeah, while they're trying to take your gun? Are you going to get into a standoff because you're in a mental health crisis and like the police show up and you don't react well? Like, these are valid things
to consider. Some people are pointing out like the best case scenario for a lot of people is like a massive like ambulance bill, and you know, the worst case scenario is they get shot like 20 times by the police. So, although it is interesting. So we've, you know, I'd say the first like mass media event that we were really exposed to was Columbine, like in terms of the staying power and like how long people were talking about that. And it does seem like this most recent Parkland incident has had somewhat more of a shift compared to even say like the Vegas shooting or.
Yeah. Cause the Vegas shooting was out of the news almost immediately. Yeah, and people thought this one would be too. And then it's still, we're still talking.
You sort
about
of
it.
Wonder, cause the Vegas shooting had obviously many more casualties, but this was, you know, school children who are very plugged in sort of the social media world. And
yeah, I think it's a number of factors there. I think it's one, they have a lot more direct sort of access through social media to like tell their own stories. Two, the kids who are in high school now were in elementary school when Sandy Hook happened, or at least a lot of them were. And so, you know, they feel like you didn't keep us safe that time and you still didn't keep us safe now. And then the third thing is that because they aren't the first one, and this is the first like really, really big high school shooting that happened, you know, with a ton of casualties and so forth. That definitely helped. There's also allegedly, I don't know, this is the story that's going around. I haven't looked into it to like see if this is true, but supposedly like the AP Gov teacher at their school happened to be doing lessons on special interest groups the day of the shooting and had taught 4 classes worth of students that day about how the NRA is an example of a very powerful political interest group with immense lobbying power. And so a lot of these kids were able to go on TV right away, which, you know, then leads to the right wing people insisting they're crisis actors or whatever. But like, it's not that they're crisis actors. It's that they literally had a lesson on this right before, which is a testament to the power of public school education and also why conservatives hate public school education. But, you know, I think there has also been some controversy over some of the specific proposals that these teenagers at Parkland have come up with. And I am a little leery of like going into the criticism of that as well, because like a lot of them, as we saw from the speaker today, are still like very clearly experiencing severe PTSD on a daily basis and are like really having a hard time handling the situation, which is completely normal and everything. People decided to treat them as, apart from the people saying they're crisis actors, the people who were supporting decided to like put them on this weird pedestal of like, the teens and children are going to save us and they're so great and whatever. And it's like, but they're also teenagers. They're also people who just went through this really tough thing. Like, you got to cut them a little bit of slack and like understand that they're going to make some mistakes. They're going to, you know, adults are going to hand them a list of policy things that are maybe questionable. And they're going to say, okay, this, you know, and like,
they're going to have some rallies in Tel Aviv and Dubai.
Yeah. So like, it's always going to be a little dicey. Plus it's not like they elected any one of them leader. I don't think, like, I think it's sort of a collective process and sometimes people are going to go do some stuff on their own. Like, so you have to be a little careful about that. I can understand though, why people are concerned about some of the proposals they've endorsed. Cause as you said, there's like one of the federal ones they want is to like significantly roll back privacy protections, with mental health providers and like get the police more involved. And people are saying, well, that's a bad thing on itself, as we just talked about, but also B, like, is contradictory with their claims to saying like that they are in line with the Ferguson related the Black Lives Matter protests, that they've been, to their credit, have been trying to say like, you're treating us much better than you treated the Black Lives Matter protesters all across the country in 2014 and 2015. Like, you need to take them seriously too. But then it's like, but then they're endorsing these sort of pro expansion of policing stuff, which
when it's coming to weapons and the police, we should probably try to disarm them.
Right. I mean, that's
getting
like
them to disarm us.
Right. I mean, there's huge problems of police shooting other off-duty police who are, you know, black or Latino. There's police shooting their partner, you know, wives and girlfriends. There's all kinds of issues related to that. And then also just the, you know, shootings like we saw in Ferguson or the one that just happened in Sacramento that Nate mentioned earlier. Like, there are probably a lot of police roles that don't need to be carrying guns in the first place. And in general, like, we need to, you know, completely rethink how we're doing policing in this country. But like, I can understand like that they might stumble on some of these things if someone hands them a policy proposal and like they're not necessarily coming from the background of thinking like, you know, that there's an issue with the police. We have to give them a little bit of leeway and like just gently try to like push them in the right direction, I think, and stuff, and raise these concerns, but not like not be like, oh, you stabbed me through the heart. I trusted you. You were supposed to save us. Like, that's
right.
Putting too much on them.
Always quite skeptical of that anyway.
Let's close this segment by talking briefly about the protests in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is, which a lot of people, even in Massachusetts, don't realize, I guess, is that we still have, it used to be much, much larger. It used to be like a national hub of gun manufacturing, but it is still a significant center for gun manufacturing, is the Smith & Wesson plant that makes the AR-15 weapons that were used in Sandy Hook and the Parkland shooting and various others. There was a very long Washington Post article talking about that, interviewing people who live in the community, interviewing people who protested, interviewing folks who have worked or know someone who worked at the company. They actually laid off a whole bunch of people in the past year or so because, Obama's out of office, so all of a sudden the demand for guns has gone way down because all the crazy people who were buying guns because they were mad at the black president have stopped buying as many guns. That raises sort of broader issues of like, what do you do when the big hub industry in your community or one of them is like this merchant of death operation? And that is a, you know, ongoing, and it's the same thing with military bases and, you know, defense
or
contractors
coal
and stuff.
Or yeah. Things like that. Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, the Washington Post story is interesting. There's also something from the Globe March 13th. I think they actually quote the same guy, Hussein Abedi. And, you know, he's a 19-year-old Springfield Central High student. And, you know, there's only about a mile between the high school and the Smith & Wesson headquarters. And he talks about how, you know, he lives in one of the most dangerous parts of Springfield. So, you know, as we were talking about with Roxbury and Back Bay, you know, somewhere like Newton, it's almost unimaginable. But there's, you know, quite high crime rates and shootings are quite common in places like, say, Lowell, Lawrence, Springfield, things like that. So, you know, it's, you know, there's obviously both a racial and economic component to that. So students like Abedi were outside, you know, in sort of in the snow outside of the barbed gates of Smith & Wesson headquarters, demanding a meeting face-to-face with the gun maker or people, you know, inside of him. He's like, I come here every day, hope that my family is safe, Abedi said, hope that gun violence has not taken them away from me. Mentioning that, yes, Massachusetts is the safest state in the country when it comes to gun violence, but is one of the largest manufacturers of firearms. And Francesa Brown, whose son was shot to death not far from the headquarters there, says, my child in Springfield is just as precious as a child in Parkland. So her son was killed in 2006 and his homicide remains unsolved. So, you know, there were, you know, people out sort of shivering in the cold. People saying like, I don't know about you, but I'm tired of thoughts and prayers coming from our political leaders. And it's not because I'm against prayer, but, you know, just sort of, he says prayer is a prelude to action in which we get our vision to align with God's vision. And then we act. And that, yeah, that's sort of been a thing, like all politicians have to come out and say, oh, thoughts and prayers. Oh no, this is terrible. Just they're not going to do anything, obviously.
And in these articles, like, these journalists can't get the local politicians and, you know, the Chamber of Commerce or whatever to like go on the record saying anything critical about this company because, you know, hundreds of people have their jobs there. But as you said, you know, I mean, we're having these same conversations with any number of industries, oil, gas, coal, military bases, defense plants, like, these are conversations that we're just going to have. And, there's that congressional candidate running for the open seat in Hawaii, Kaniela Ng, who there was an interview recently where he made a comment because he wants to close the military bases, and he says they make Hawaii a target and they basically become this sort of self-sustaining thing of like, we have to, you know, we have to do more military stuff in order to justify keeping these bases, which then leads us to, you know, have this really imperialist foreign policy and everything. And then it's like, well, what do you do about the jobs? And he's like, yeah, we're going to have to find new jobs for these people. Like, absolutely. But you, at a certain point, you have to draw a line and say, this industry exists and is perpetuated by death and exporting death. And you can't keep doing that. You can't have your economy based on that. I think there's also a similar conversation to be had about like communities where the prison or the jail is a major economic hub, right? Like, then that leads to you trying to imprison more people. So you have more jobs like providing services to the prison or being guards at the prison or whatever. Like, you have to have these tough conversations, like, and say, look, yeah, we need to replace these people's incomes. We need to find them new jobs, et cetera. But we can't keep having these, you know, we can't say, oh, we're, you know, above this gun violence and we don't want these guns here, but we're happy to make them, get the jobs from them, sell them to other states, that sort of thing, get the tax revenue from it. So those are conversations that we're going to have to have.
Yeah, just one final quote from a Boston high school student, Ekan Sharif, 17, basically saying that any effort toward solutions, you know, must address urban violence as well. We don't see this in the current debate, she said. The trauma of losing a loved one is just as great, no matter if it's in Sandy Hook or Chicago. So sort of there needs to be sort of a very holistic approach. I don't think it's enough to just sort of do these targeted reforms that are maybe only going to we're going to put rocks in your classroom so you can throw rocks at the shooter. That was one proposal, just like put a bucket of rocks somewhere and like have these like affluent suburban kids like throw rocks at it. I mean, a lot of it is madness, but hopefully there's some positive benefits of all this activism. So
again, you know, this is just sort of a cursory overview of some things that we had some thoughts on, but sort of that's some things we wanted to talk about. All right, when we come back in just a moment from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD, we will be talking about the history of New England radicalism, some really important lessons to be learned from historical incidents that apply to today. So please stick around. We'll be back in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about radical history in New England. In future, we're hoping to do some, you know, coverage of various radical history in other parts of the country. For example, we'll do some stuff on Idaho on a future episode when Rachel is back on the show. But let's talk about New England. Obviously, a ton of things that could be covered, so we've just selected you know, several highlights that we wanted to focus on this week. Nate, where should we start on the narrative about New England radicalism?
Right. So, yeah, as obviously you know, we both grew up here in Newton with Howard Zinn nearby, and that being an influence sort of thing in thinking about history. And so, as you mentioned, there's tons of stuff we could cover, whether it's, you know, King Philip's War, Emma Goldman's ice cream shop in Springfield, Massachusetts, Sacco and Vanzetti, we were just talking about, so all sorts of different things. But I figured that it might be a good idea to look at some of these large strikes that happened, as well as several sort of conflict incidents, a lot of them involving sort of process of white supremacy, things like that. So I think starting with the Lowell Mill strikes is a good place to start. That sort of, it is emphasized somewhat in our education here in Massachusetts, field trips to the Lowell Mills, things like that.
I think certainly more than in other areas of the country, that was a big thing because, and my understanding from people who are maybe 10 or 15 years older than us, as soon as the National Park Service turned the Lowell Mill sort of complex into a national park and everything, a national historical park, all of the public schools in the area pretty much started doing like regular field trips to that. And so I think it was sort of a big part of the curriculum in a way that is probably not true for a lot of other areas of the country. I think maybe West Virginia, which we talked about on the last episode, is another area that has a lot of like labor militancy history taught in the curriculum, although maybe it's not anymore. I don't really know, but my understanding is that it's still taught there. But in Massachusetts, like the Lowell stuff is like a huge thing. And that's like a very early piece of the labor movement in this country, because this is like the birth of, you know, even before unions, basically.
Yeah, sort of the spearhead of industrialization sort of happened up that sort of Merrimack Valley, stretching up into New Hampshire and things like that. So obviously in Lowell, we were just talking about how the large population of sort of young women coming in to work in these factories, and it sort of led to a working class intellectual culture where there was a lot of sort of libraries, books being traded around, and described as the literary mill girls. And sort of just this was a large part of the culture there. A lot of people coming from places where books were not common or there were no books. There were strikes in both 1834 and 1836. As a result of in 34, there was a 15% wage reduction requested by the board of directors there, and it led to a turnout strike where they sort of, women withdrew their savings from various banks, causing runs. Unfortunately, the strike did not work, and a lot of them had to return to work at reduced pay. But sort of that was like an early spark of labor militancy. It eventually led to another one several years later. And this is going on amongst economic downturns. And eventually in 36, there was another strike, and there was enormous support. This one I think doubled the number of strikers, 1,500 in this one. So compared to 34, and eventually there was a rent hike that was rescinded as a result. So they actually did get some more substantial results out of that strike, and it led to the formation of the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association with organizers like Sarah Bagley, who is quite well known at the time, although sort of has somewhat been obscured in history. So I figured that it's important to mention her. And yeah, so it seems like this is, as you mentioned before, a lot of unions and this Lowell and the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association was sort of an example of early political action by women who at that point, of course, could not vote. But they were sending petitions to the Massachusetts legislature, thousands of signatures demanding safer workplaces, 10-hour day, things like that. So, you know, that sort of was a big thing in a lot of different areas of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. So think of places like Waltham, Fall River, Manchester, Nashua, where you can still see large factories stretching back to that era. So it's sort of important to think about that and how this has been going on for, nearly 200 years in this country. So this is something with a long tradition and a long history.
Something that I think we've talked about previously on the show, I'm pretty sure, which goes to a point that you were just mentioning about the women and the lack of a right to vote. In Massachusetts, women did not get the right to vote until 1920 with the federal amendment came in. Some states had already allowed women to vote, but that was not one of them in Massachusetts. And that's almost 100 years after the time period that we're talking about. It is interesting, this like figuring out how to sort of work the system and achieve various things without actually being able to participate fully in it. And I think there is, like, obviously it's better if you're able to participate in the system and get things done that way and be able to vote and that's all that, you know, that's probably the better course of action if that's a course of action available to you. But I think there is a lesson in this, which is something that, you know, was not just done by the Lowell Mill Girls, but plenty of other people who were oppressed and marginalized and disenfranchised for many years in the United States, which is like that sometimes you take radical action on your own, you know, and organize each other to apply various pressure using other mechanisms, even if you don't have those options available. I think sort of bigger picture, and to bring it back to the present day, not just on that point about the efficacy or lack thereof of the normal political system and the legislative system, which is, I think, a lot of concerns for people who are think that reasonably that the democracy has been sort of bought out and corrupted, and that there's, you know, just nothing that you can get done through the normal system. Like, there's a lot of frustration that we hear about. You know, we talked about last week the unions facing this sort of existential threat from the Janus case coming up through the Supreme Court. And I think this Supreme Court in general is going to do a lot to sort of break the power of unions. And again, like, having a union better than not having a union. There's plenty of data to back that up about sort of the economic and social consequences and benefits of having a union. But this notion that, like, this is the end of the world for labor and our ability to organize and that sort of thing in the absence of a union, if they are indeed destroyed by the Supreme Court or the Republican Congress or the, you know, Department of Labor, National Labor Relations Board, any of these institutions, this is sort of a reminder that, like, there didn't used to be unions. A lot of the really huge, like, strikes in this country historically, this is one of the sort of earliest ones, and there had been other ones in other countries as well that predated this, but this is one of the big famous ones early on. But even later, much later, you had, like, people who were organizing you know, wildcat strikes that were not backed by a union, often because that was either illegal or they just didn't have one yet. And then, you know, even in the 20th century, there were often situations where, and this goes to the point we were talking about with West Virginia last week, where the union leadership wasn't authorizing a strike and they wouldn't go along with it. And the members decided to do a walkout anyway. And so there is a model here, which is something that I think a lot of, like, sort of syndicalists, you know, radical left, you know, people who aren't necessarily a fan of the government-based approach and aren't necessarily even a fan of, like, organized union leadership, they're saying, look, there is a model that has worked in the past that is available to us, that gives us this other option, this other pathway for organizing each other and leading ourselves, basically, the ultimate form of self-determination and self-governance. And that's something that I've been interested to, like, read more about. And I think it's a good thing to bring up in this context of this discussion.
Right. And this also ties into the next strike I wanted to talk about, the 1912 Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, as it's termed. There's an article here by Robert Forent, a UMass Lowell history professor and chair of the Bread and Roses Centennial Committee. So he's sort of plugged into all of this. And the article challenges the assumption found in a lot of sort of history textbooks when it's mentioned at all. Apparently, it wasn't mentioned in 10 out of 12 major U.S. history textbooks in 2011 survey. And the ones that did reference it describe it as erupting or sort of spontaneous. And it was even talked about at the time. IWW organizer James P. Thompson said in October 1912 issue of Solidarity, it's absolutely foolish to say the strike happened without any apparent cause, that it was lightning out of clear sky. As a matter of fact, it was a harvest. It was a result of seeds sown before. And so the article describes how the IWW, the Italian Socialist Federation, played a pretty significant role in the strikes. A lot of these mills and factories were extremely immigrant-heavy. So whether it's Italians or Franco-Belgians, they were working as cooperative models established after institutions in France and Belgium, including they set up their own bakery and grocery store and were feeding the children of striking workers. And a lot of these were extremely multilingual. So there were mass meetings at which speakers were talking in English, Italian, Polish, French. There were Syrians, Germans, Flemish, so also Armenian, Russian. And so you have all sorts of different groups coming together in addition to female workers and the wives of the male workers. So this was very large sort of all across the board strike. They were getting, so it went on for about 2 months, and eventually the American Woolen Committee was forced to give a 5% pay increase overall, and so yeah, eventually met all of the four demands that they were going for, although this did mention that this was sort of the high point of the IWW. You know, obviously the first Red Scare was happening around that time, so that, you know, had an impact on them, and they're saying by the summer of 1913, the local 20 of the IWW only had 700 members, up from 15,000 at the time of the trial where some of the IWW organizers were being prosecuted, although they were eventually acquitted. So, yeah, that's sort of this article notes that, you know, it does prove at the time the American Federation of Labor, AFL, they were wrong in believing that unskilled foreign-speaking workers were incapable of organizing, and they had this strike sort of coined new strategies such as the moving picket line. And the sort of there was a spirit as well of just strong solidarity, even across the differences of language and, you know, sort of nationality and things like that. So this was sort of a pretty significant in the history, you know, just of a major coming together and taking on pretty established powers. So, yeah, overall, their four demands were met: a 15% wage increase, an acceptance of the 54-hour work week, an end to premium and the bonus system, a double pay for overtime, and no retaliation against workers who struck. So all these things, obviously, they're still being demanded. These are relevant even today. So
yeah, an esprit de corps among the different people that probably the management and ownership was not expecting. And, you know, we've talked, I think we mentioned last week, too, that some of the strike stuff in West Virginia was organized by IWW members within the union who were, you know, willing to defy union leadership and just organize from the ground up. So the IWW is still around. They're still active in various capacities. I think they've been really heavily involved in prison strikes recently. I know there's some going on down in, I think, Florida right now, and there's various others across the South. And, you know, I think that it would be great to get prisoners' unions in general that, you know, represent the interests of the prisoners in terms of health and safety issues and also represent them in terms of bargaining power for the prison labor, which is certainly a growing issue that people talk more about now than they had in years past, I think. But, you know, in the interim, IWW showing that there is still this model in the absence of a union where people can organize themselves and each other to resist these things. Now, I guess that gets to like a broader question that we don't really have the time or expertise to delve into today, which is like, you know, is that a tactical thing or is that a, you know, sort of broader ideological thing? Because obviously the way that they organize has to do with a broader ideology that they have in terms of like how sort of society should be governed. But regardless of whether or not you agree with that, there's certainly something to be learned from a lot of the tactical work that they've done. But as Nate noted, you know, a lot of their stuff sort of peaked right before World War One. They, you know, a lot of these sort of more syndicalist, anarchist type groups were active in, you know, the 1880s, 1890s, and the, you know, the first 15 years of the 20th century. Anarchists, obviously, Nate alluded earlier to Sacco and Vanzetti. We're not going to get too much into that, but I think there's been a lot of sort of popular misunderstanding of what anarchism was, because obviously there were some, you know, people doing like targeted assassinations and bombings and things like that. But that's not really the core of what anarchism was about. And again, we're not really experts on this subject either, but just like, you know, sort of brief overview there is again, it's more of this approach of like, we don't necessarily need the government. We can govern ourselves through these sort of local entities, which doesn't necessarily hold up in the same way that it did at the time in the modern context, because we're not all working in like factories or on like we're not in discrete units in the way that we were at the time necessarily. But again, there are things you can take away from that and learn. And there is a modern version of that has been updated for the modern world. So I'm not getting into that right now, but that's just sort of a reminder of like, you know, that sort of legacy was lost in sort of the headline grabbing stuff about like targeted assassinations and things like that, right, which is not really the big picture there.
Just wanted to throw in a couple more details from the strike. You had going to people's or the houses of scabs at night and singing to their inhabitants with loud voices. I believe actually anti-fascist groups have done that with fascists, just like go outside their houses and sing. That's sort of in a more modern context, but people marching down the street singing Internationale. In fact, actually, there were some operatives of the American Woolen Company who planted a bomb at one point, or a cache of dynamite, and they were fined for that. So yeah, there's just people's machines were getting smashed up by the strikers. You had IWW sent Big Bill Haywood, you know, greeted cheering at the train station. So this is sort of the the sort of not quite the revolutionary moment. In fact, Bill, you've mentioned before about the 1917.
Yeah, there was a lot of syndicalists, like, right, and, which I think also probably contributes, even, you know, because there's obviously they were a little damaged by the sort of anarchism legacy before World War One, but then World War One comes along, you start getting that first Red Scare, as you alluded to earlier, and then you know, then they're really sort of hurt also by the competition with the more like Bolshevik type groups rather than the sort of like anarcho-syndicalist approach.
Right. So I think the next thing we wanted to talk about was the protests around Birth of a Nation. So there's an article that we've linked to the Boston Globe from 2016, when Birth of a Nation sparked a riot in Boston, talking about how there was sort of the tour of Birth of a Nation. You know, of course, they showed it at the White House. They brought it to Boston here. And then so leading the opposition to this was William Monroe Trotter, prominent civil rights leader and radical newspaper editor, who was one of those, who was as well known as people like Booker T. Washington, W.E. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, but we don't sort of, his name is not as remembered in history as those are, but he was the first black member of Harvard's Phi Beta Kappa. You know, he had his own newspaper, sort of taking an antagonistic stance towards Booker T. Washington's sort of prominence in the national civil rights conversation, and sort of taking a more radical direct action approach. So it was when Birth of a Nation came into town, they basically engaged in sort of large marches against the theater when they tried to down at Tremont, so on Tremont Street in Boston. And they were marching there and trying to get in, and they were refused because the theater didn't sell tickets to black people. There was melees, and this continued multiple times. They eventually did not run the movie out of town, of course, but they had a pretty significant impact just in terms of getting people to pay attention. While the film obviously was a Klan recruitment tool, but apparently the protests and controversy around it led to the NAACP growing from about 3,000 to 10,000 members, as in many cases, largely as a result of the film protests. So this was sort of like a galvanizing moment where people sort of came together. So this article talks about how the challenge to Griffith had also brought together competing factions in the movement, Trotterites, Bookerites, and the NAACP. It does seem like this was sort of a mass moment where people were coming together and just sort of, and, you know, as we talk about things like no platforming now and sort of these sort of racist provocateurs going around and talking, this is in many ways quite similar to conversations we've been having for over 100 years, specifically in media. So Trotter, he realized that the power of the medium of film, and he knew that he could circulate a year's worth of newspapers and still not come close to reaching the kind of mass audience that Griffith was finding with his movie. So, you know, this was sort of leading towards the, you know, we actually have to do something about this. We can't just sort of write op-eds or, you know, just sort of say, oh, this is bad. We, you know, we actually have to take direct action here. And so just sort of the image of, you know, this, you know, this was 1915, and you have, I think it was a couple hundred or maybe about 1,000 black people just marching up Tremont Street to protest this. I mean, this was something that, you know, with Boston's quite a history with racism, white supremacy, it's interesting to sort of see the other side of that, where there was actually organized direct action and protest against it in a time where you maybe wouldn't think about that being a sort of prominent thing that's happening. So
right, and again, to remind everyone, the reason we don't necessarily think of it that way automatically is because that's how the history is written, right? Like that the history is not written to include these sort of vignettes in the textbooks and so forth.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty key part of it. And as we mentioned with some of these other strikes, now they're maybe sort of mentioned a little bit more just because even the buildings are still there. But a lot of these other things are not quite remembered as well, as maybe we'll talk a little bit more in some of these other things that we want to talk about that happened up in Maine. So if we want to continue on to that. So I guess the first thing maybe we want to mention is another thing involving the IWW. They were literally battling against the Ku Klux Klan up in Maine, which has actually been was one of the centers of activity for the second Klan, in addition to places like, say, Indiana and things like that. But Maine was quite heavily involved in all of that. So I'm reading from the Activist History Review here, and they're sort of contextualizing this amongst the events in Charlottesville and everything like that. So, you know, obviously this there's some historical continuity here, but, you know, when you think about Paul LePage, current governor of Maine, sort of the proto-Trump, there was actually in 1924, the Maine Ku Klux Klan was very happy because their favorite candidate for governor, Republican State Senator Ralph Owen Brewster, had just been elected in to become the governor of Maine. Opponent had declared this Republican victory was a distinct victory for the Ku Klux Klan. Several months before that, by the Portland Press Herald, a drawn battle between the predominantly Franco-American Catholic lumbermen organized by the Industrial Workers of the World in the small town of Greenville. And the Klan was trying to expel labor organizers through intimidation and obviously their anti-Catholic bias and conspiracies and trying to terrorize people in the middle of the night. And of course, they had their own newspaper, and I'm looking actually at sort of comics they had in their newspaper, which are quite disturbing. And so, you know, you have the IWW show up and they come sort of and just demand that they're going to protect the workers and sort of call the Battle of Greenville. When asked why organizers were being opposed, declared it was because we want good wages, 8 hours a day in the lumber camps and clean linens in our beds. The day of the old logging camp and the lumberjacks is about over with. And so they marched into town, and there were also Klan was also there, and the Klan marched, tried to expel them from their boarding houses and things like that. And so, yeah, the latest local paper reported the latest story is the Ku Klux Klan is backing up the selectmen who have attempted to have the organizers expelled, told organizers they must leave town or being rejected. And Pease mocked the Klan and its support for the capitalist order in Greenville, saying, "We are going to stick, and if the Klan starts anything, the IWW will finish it. The slave drivers, the Great Northern Paper Company, and the Hollingsworth and Whitney paper mills, people do not want us here, but we are too strong for them." And they, so yeah, as I mentioned, a lot of these IWW lumbermen were French Catholic, so this was sort of a, that was a fault line there. And so, you know, you sort of have, and eventually actually including Pease, they were thrown in jail, you know, sort of after this initial confrontation, were charged with the organization. And then you had more IWWs marching into town, go to the courthouse. They actually came a day too early for the trial. But eventually, so the IWW, they were thrown in jail for a little while, Pease and others, I believe. And, yeah, this is sort of, and then the article zooms out a little bit more, just talking about how, you know, Maine's status as quote unquote vacation land and sort of idyllic. And then a lot of this history is sort of swept under the ground. And, you know, there's now maybe this is being talked about a little bit more because, you know, you have Paul LePage sort of bringing it quite into view with his comments about heroin traffickers who impregnate white women and things like that. I mean, it's sort of hard to ignore at that point, but yeah. So despite Maine's reputation as an idyllic vacation land, it has been and continues to be the site of fierce ethnic rivalry, political repression, and vigilantism. These are not isolated incidents or events that can be consigned to the dustbin of history. Donald Trump's presidential campaign was fueled by anti-immigrant and racial rhetoric, which has legitimized the resurgence of hate groups in Maine and across the country. And a links to an article in the Portland Press Herald talking about KKK flyers disturb residents of Freeport neighborhood. And so you have people passing out KKK literature in Augusta and Freeport and other places. So, and we've seen that happening around the country as well, but that's sort of something that continues to this day. And then another example of the, sort of this that I recently learned about was of this political repression was the incident in Malaga Island, which is somewhat sort of up the coast of Maine a little bit near Phillipsburg, I guess it's called. And this is reading from an author we know, Colin Woodard. Portland Press Herald reporter, author of several books. And he talks about how basically there was a community of, it was a multi-ethnic community, black, white, mixed race, of about 40 people living on this island, sort of just living off the land, fishing, catching lobster, things like that. They had a their schoolhouse there, and basically it was cleansed. Their schoolhouse was removed. They were expelled from the island by the government. Some of them were incarcerated in questionable grounds at the main school for the feeble-minded, where most of them spent the rest of their lives. And apparently the island schoolhouse was dismantled and relocated to Louds Island in Muscongus Bay, where apparently my family may or may not have benefited materially from that in some way. So it's important to keep that in mind. But basically, and this was interesting to know, apparently they found some of the handwriting samples of the students of this school, and apparently their handwriting was like perfect, and they were clearly not, you know, quote unquote, feeble-minded or anything like that. But yeah, basically,
I guess underscores the issue of being concerned about the government potentially institutionalizing people involuntarily by declaring them mentally ill. Like, that can be used as a pretext for things. So there's a reason some people are always suspicious about that.
Right. Well, you know, this is the time of the burgeoning eugenics movement. And, you know, you have Oliver Wendell Holmes talking about three generations of idiots is enough for imbeciles, I guess was his turn of phrase there in the Buck v. Bell case. But yeah, this sort of is quite small island, but it was thought to be sort of a prime real estate for, I don't know, vacation or development, things like that. Although apparently there hasn't been much built on the island in about the century since then. So, you know, this was something that's come to light recently. There was a sort of radio documentary in 2009 about it. And there was a play apparently recently that was put on. And so actually going back to the feeble-minded thing, apparently some of the justification they used was they failed to identify a telephone, which they had no need to know what that is because they're living on an island. Really, so they had not seen it before. They didn't know that William Howard Taft had succeeded Teddy Roosevelt as president. I don't know, they maybe get their newspaper or something like that. But yeah, those. So eventually they were told that you basically have to get out of there by July 1912. And so the cemetery was cleared. The bodies were dug up. The island was sold to a close friend of the a business partner of the chair of the executive council, Dr. Gustavus Kilgore.
Real villain name.
Right, exactly. And nobody has lived on the island since. So you have this mixed race community just wiped out, and then nothing replaced it. It's almost like their main objection was there was a mixed race community there. So there was also a children's book written about the tragedy, Lizzie Bright and the Buckminster Boy, which won the Newbery Honor in 2005, and a lyric play based on it premiered in Minneapolis this March. I think I have family members who have gone to see that. That's sort of how I found out about it, but it seems like this has sort of been known for a little while, but it hasn't really been expanded upon. And there was, I guess, an exhibit that even Paul LePage went to at one of the main museums, but it doesn't seem like this sort of example has been sort of shared widely as an example of, you know, sort of the white supremacy in the North. There have been, you know, sort of more discussions about things like in the South. Like there was a county, I think it's called Forsyth County outside of Atlanta, where just one day they ran out all the black people that were living in the county to live there for, you know, hundreds of years. They just, you know, ethnically cleansed it basically. Or other things like the Tulsa race riots, where Black Wall Street was literally bombed from airplanes and things like that. So that's sort of come into the national consciousness, I feel like, a little bit more. But a lot of these incidents in the North and elsewhere that sort of, they just don't get talked about and they sort of get swept under the rug there.
All right. Well, that is going to be our time for this week. And Nate, thank you so much for being here this week to talk about both of these, all of these issues.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.